for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Botox is well known for its cosmetic and medical uses. On Monday, the Washington Post reported that a black market for Botox has raised concerns that terrorists could get a hold of the botulinum toxin from illicit labs. Joining us in the studio, dermatologist Tina Ulster of Georgetown University, Colonel Randall Larson. He's executive director of the Government WMD and Terrorism Commission, and Marina Voronova-Abrams, a former Russia-based bioweapons expert. Joining us by phone from Monterey, California, Kenneth Coleman at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies. I do invite your calls, questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us on Facebook and with a tweet. Good morning to all of you and welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. With you, Diane.
First of all, just transparency in broadcasting. I've just come back from Portland, Oregon, where I received an injection of Botox for my spasmodic dysphonia, the voice condition that does affect me. So I have a little bit of experience with Botox. But Dr. Ulster, give our listeners a sense of exactly what Botox is and does.
Well, Botox we've been using medically for many, many years. I use it cosmetically to reduce muscle contractions, which is the reason why you had it for your spasmodic dysphonia. We actually use it to reduce furrows in the brow and crow's feet, wrinkles on the face and whatnot. But we use it at very low dosages, meaning that we just use a teeny bit to immobilize muscle activity. Obviously, the big concern here, and I think the reason why we have the group of experts we have today, is to talk about its use for bioterrorism, which is a totally different thing than what I use it for.
How much of the toxin is actually in the drug as you use it?
Well, we use a very dilute amount in each of the vials that we get for cosmetic Botox. There's only 100 units of a very mild form of the Botox toxin. And so you would have to have hundreds of those vials in a highly purified extract in order to render any harm to the population at large. In fact, for instance, your spasmodic dysphonia, you're only getting probably about anywhere between 10 and 20 units, which is a very, very low amount.
You have no idea. I am down to 0.175 units. That's how small a dose I receive each 4 months. Forgive me. Dr. Tina Ulster, she's clinical professor of dermatology at Georgetown University Medical Center. She's also director of the Washington Institute of Dermatologic Laser Surgery. Turning to you now, Ken Coleman, how much does it actually take to kill a person? Ken Coleman, are you there? Oh, dear. He's dropped off. All right, we'll get him back. Colonel Randall Larson, let me direct that question to you.
Well, Diane, it's incredibly small amounts. That's why you hear people say about, you could just put in a regular mixing bowl in your kitchen would be enough to kill the entire population of the United States. And botulinum toxin is the most deadly substance we know of. That's all correct. Of course, there is this issue about how you would distribute it to that entire, 6 billion population. But we're talking about a nanogram, maybe 70 nanograms. A nanogram is 1/1,000,000th of a gram. So it's not very much. It is incredibly potent when it's at the full strength. The good news is, I think, and we'll hear more from Ken about this, is the United States used to have an offensive biological warfare program. That was part of our war plans in the 60s. President Nixon got us out of that business in 1969. The Soviet Union had an offensive biological warfare program. They weaponized many pathogens. They looked at botulinum toxin. It was determined that it was not a very effective thing as compared to aerosolized anthrax that we worry about now, or smallpox that you would put in a dry powder, like I always carry around in my little test tube here. This is just a simulant, but that's what a biological weapon looks like. It's a dry powder. You spray it in the air and you breathe it in. Botulinum toxin is not well suited for that. It would be a wonderful weapon to use as an assassination weapon, to use on one person. You inject it in someone and they are going to die very quickly. As someone told me last night, a public health specialist, it can cause great disruption of church picnic. And you get in food poisoning or whatever, you could kill some people. And it is on the Department of Homeland Security list of those pathogens we worry about, but it's not in the same category as anthrax or smallpox.
Colonel Randall Larson, he's executive director of the Bipartisan Commission on the Prevention of Weapons of Mass Destruction, Proliferation, and Terrorism, which just issued its report evaluating the government's ability to protect the U.S. from the threat posed by WMD and terrorism. I think we have Ken Coleman back with us. Are you there, Ken?
I am. Thank you, Diane.
Tell me how much it takes of Botox or the toxin itself to kill a person. As we've just heard Colonel Larson say, it would have to be injected in, I gather, a fairly small amount. Is that correct?
It is. Well, most poisons, are measured with three different lethalities. That which you inject, that which you inhale, and that which you eat. And so those three lethalities would have a different potency depending on the route of administration.
So if you have naturally occurring botulinum toxin, for example, in a can of tuna fish, how serious a problem would that be, Marina?
Well, if we talk about a can of tuna fish or, for example, the salad, it can cause a serious outbreak in the population. People can have very serious stomach cramps, and it can also cause some neurological problems. People can become paralyzed, and it might take up to 3 days for the local authorities to understand what is actually going on.
So, but have there not been deaths, Ken Coleman, from botulinum toxin within canned foods such as tuna fish?
Oh, yes. I think we had a famous case several years ago. We have cases every year, but the famous case, I think, of the bon vivant vichyssoise soup that was contaminated with spores, and then some people ate the soup and did die. So it does, several cases appear every year. That's of minor public health significance.
But what is of major health significance right now is the concern about the black market for Botox. Ken Coleman, tell us what's going on.
Well, exactly, Diane. So what has changed in the last 10 years, and I concur completely with what Randy has said earlier, although I didn't hear all of his comments, what has changed in the last 10 years are three large trends. The first is that the market for botulinum toxin or Botox has grown from near zero 10 years ago to about $2 billion today. Any drug that has a $2 billion market is bound to attract a certain amount of black market activity. The second is the emerging technological economies, also known as the BRIC nations, have had enormous growth. And along with that enormous growth, there is a parallel growth of the black market. And the third is the fact that the Internet is now the world shopping center. So small local businesses that, used to sell, to local consumers near their own locale are now global enterprises and capable of selling throughout the world.
So tell me what it takes to manufacture botulinum toxin.
A small garage-level laboratory would be sufficient to grow it. It's more like beer making than it is anything else.
And what kinds of ingredients does it take?
Well, certainly you need to have the bacterial strains that produce it. You need some media that the bacteria grow in. You need a small fermenter. And then you need some very rudimentary purification equipment that could be bought over eBay very easily.
And I gather then anyone with cash could buy it over the Internet. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that was the key point, and that's what's changed from 10 years ago. We always felt, and I think the government felt this way, that the technological barriers to making it and purifying it were sufficient to, was a sufficient hurdle for it not to be manufactured by nefarious groups. I think what's changed now is the fact that there are several black market laboratories that have sprung up in these BRIC nations, which are advertising their wares on the Internet.
Kenneth Coleman, he's Senior Fellow for the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program. He's at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. When we come back, we're going to hear about an illegal cosmetics trader who was marketing Botox. And welcome back. We're talking about Botox, its legitimate uses, the growth of the black market in Botox, and what the government may do to address the problem. We have here in the studio Dr. Tina Ulster. She's a dermatologist at Georgetown University, Colonel Randall Larson, Executive Director of the Commission on the Prevention of Weapons of Mass Destruction, Proliferation, and Terrorism, Marina Verona Abrams. She's biosecurity reduction expert, formerly based in Central Asia and Russia. She currently works at the Security and Sustainability Program of Global Green USA. And joining us on the line is Kenneth Coleman, Senior Fellow for the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferations Program at the Monterey Institute for International Studies. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Marina, tell us about the illegal cosmetics trader that you researched.
Well, when Dr. Coleman and Dr. Zelinska started writing their research on counterfeit Botox, they asked me to look into the situation in former Soviet Union, especially in Russia and Central Asia. And according to the data I was able to obtain, most counterfeit Botox is coming to Russia from China and is widely distributed in various parts of Russia, but especially in Far East, and is distributed in Central Asia. The Rahman's case, which is mentioned in the article this Monday in Washington Post, Rahman case was brought to my attention when I inquired about possible producers within Russia, on the territory of Russia. And I was able to get the information about that the person who is coming to St. Petersburg and apparently with a suitcase full of vials of counterfeit Botox. And when he was asked how many of them you can supply, he would say, you want 500, I can bring you 500 vials. You want 1,000, I can bring you 1,000. So that is a pretty scary case. However, I'd like to say that there is no data or information where he's bringing that Botox from. Is it from Chechnya? Do we have a lab in Chechnya? Or is he just a part of a larger trafficking network coming from China?
Now, when you call it counterfeit Botox, are you saying that it's simply produced outside of legitimate laboratories, or are you saying it is equally as lethal as anything produced by a legitimate, recognized laboratory?
Equally as lethal? I don't think there are labs that officially produce lethal Botox these days. The official Botox is for medical and cosmetic purposes.
But aren't
it's not
you,
dangerous. But counterfeit Botox is produced illegally in some laboratories in remote areas, and we don't actually know what is the actual substance in that vials. What is the percentage of the toxin in those vials? It can be very diluted, but it can have a dangerous proportion of toxin too. And I would say that the real problem that we're talking about is that we actually have so little information about who is making that counterfeit Botox, who is selling it, and we don't really know where the labs are, who their clients are, who are their distributors, and what is the actual toxin concentration in those vials.
And that becomes the question, Ken Coleman, this whole idea of legitimately produced Botox and that produced as counterfeit, have we gotten our hands on both and examined chemically the differences?
What we have found and some of our collaborators have found in looking at the contents of some of these vials is that the vials, the black market vials, do indeed contain some Botox. Now, it is always of varying potency and purity. And that's the problem with all black market material, is you never know what you're going to get. But the fact that these vials were analyzed and found to contain Botox basically means that there are laboratories producing it and capable of producing it and therefore supplying the black market.
How many companies legally produce Botox, Ken Coleman?
I believe there are 8 around the world. These are legitimate, and let me underscore, there has never been a problem with legitimate companies, pharmaceutical companies, producing vials of Botox. And so that has never been a security threat, and we just want to underscore that the vials themselves, made and produced from legitimate companies, have never been a problem.
How many companies in this country produce Botox?
We have three in the United States. There's one in South Korea. There's another in India. There's a legitimate company in China. One in France and one in Germany.
But here in this country, you say there are three. I know of Allergan. Who else?
One is called Solstice, and one is called Mentor.
So let me ask you, Dr. Alster, when you receive the Botox that you are going to use for cosmetic purposes, you're dependent on the laboratory from which they come for the real thing. Is that correct?
That's correct. And in fact, anybody that uses cosmetic Botox should only be ordering it from Allergan, who is here in the U.S. I think they actually paired up with Mentor. So those are the two big companies here in the U.S. And we get 100 units in a purified form, not the highly toxic form. It's a dilute amount, a very dilute amount inside a vial. And then we reconstitute it with a certain amount of fluid in order to make it a liquid for injection. So we only have 100 units, but not of the pure toxin. This is the medical toxin.
See.
So it's very different than, I think, what we're talking about in terms of using it for bioterrorism.
So, Randall Larson, your commission looked at this issue of counterfeit Botox, Botox proliferating, Botox potential use as a terrorist weapon. Tell us what you found.
Well, actually, Diane, we did not look at Botox. We looked at a wide range of things. Botulinum toxin would certainly be one of them, and it's on the Department of Homeland Security list. What our commission discovered was America's not prepared to respond to any sort of anthrax attack. Botulinum toxin, one of the studies that we have seen is there was question about could it be put in the milk supply. And there was it was a kind of a good news study, came out of Stanford University. There are so many, I think about 25% of the milk that's produced in the United States comes from California. So it was a great place to study it. And that there are so many checks and balances, how often they clean the tanks and do all this. And that it turned out that, well, everything's always possible or whatever. But it was not the type of scenario that the terrorist would see was a very great vulnerability. So our concern, though, that we released yesterday, our report was America is not prepared, whether you're talking about emergency room capacity. We still use 60-year-old technology to make vaccines, which is why we didn't have enough H1N1 vaccine this fall. Our public health system is not properly funded. So we gave the government, that's the White House, Congress, and federal, state, and local, we gave them an F. That's America's capability to respond to a biological weapon. Shortly after the report was released, the White House said the president would address that tonight in the State of the Union. So we are looking forward to see what we're going to do. There should be a strategy for this, Diane. We have the capability to remove biological weapons, whether it's Botox or anthrax, from the category of WMD. But we have to invest the money now, and there's a great dual benefit from doing that. We all know that we need more capacity in our emergency rooms, we need better public health, and America needs the capability to make vaccines and therapeutics faster and less expensively. Diane, why did the Minister of Health of China get his H1N1 vaccine 1 month before any American school child? I think Americans should be asking the president and their government leaders that question.
Colonel Randall Larson, he's with the Commission on the Prevention of Weapons of Mass Destruction, Proliferation, and Terrorism. They have just issued a report evaluating the government's ability to protect the U.S. from the threat posed by WMD and terrorism. Ken Coleman, how do you respond? Do you feel that botulinum toxin is among those chemicals which really do threaten the United States population in its pure or counterfeit form? How would you address that situation? Is there a possibility a terrorist organization could get the product?
The answer is yes, but I want to put this in the context of what Randy just said. It certainly is one of many threats that the United States faces. There have been certain changes in this particular market because the market has grown over the years and the black market in some of these BRIC nations have grown. But again, it is only one of many threats that we face, and we need to kind of reassess our capability in this area, and I think that's what Randy was alluding to. So I would underscore what he said. He is painting the big picture that we have a preparedness problem. Botox is just one of those.
Sure. Threats. How much policing or government oversight is there of counterfeit drugs, Ken?
Well, it's an area that is very difficult. We have difficulties in certain nations putting pressure on those nations to try to deal with all kinds of intellectual property, be it patents or copyrights or counterfeit drugs. So this is an ongoing international problem. It just so happens that this one molecule, this one medicine, can also be used as a bioterror threat. And so it gets raised to a slightly higher level of awareness. But certainly the problem of intellectual property protection and counterfeiting is a problem throughout the entire emerging technology world.
Kenneth Coleman, he's at the Monterey Institute of International Studies, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Marina, you wanted to add to that.
Yes, I would like to add that actually the such cases as Rachman's cases is a good evidence of poor cooperation between the industry and the law enforcement representatives.
How so?
Well, the truth is that the distributors of the legal Botox in Russia, for example, that's where my research was, and Central Asia, they do not feel safe. They don't feel comfortable pursuing counterfeit Botox. One should always keep in mind that black market basically means dangerous criminal groups. And in the countries where you have very weak regulations and where the counterfeit Botox is not a police priority, of course, the industry representatives, the pharmaceutical companies representatives, they don't feel safe reporting such cases, although they receive information about somebody suddenly selling illegal Botox every other week. Every week they get a call from doctors or beauty salons that somebody is trying to sell them a suspiciously cheap Botox, yet they choose not to report it.
Dr. Ulster, what are the medical issues with counterfeit Botox?
Well, clearly, if you don't know what's in the bottle, you don't know what you're injecting. And if it's not the cosmetic Botox that we have all come to know and trust, this could be highly toxic. In fact, there were a few cases, I think up to four a few years ago, we all heard about, of counterfeit Botox being used in Florida, and these people landed in the hospital on ventilators because in addition to, causing problems with, the neuromuscular system, you end up having problems with breathing and it can shut down and you die from lack of oxygen. So this was a big concern and part of the counterfeit Botox situation. Clearly, this is something that we know as physicians that we don't buy things or should not buy things that are not approved for use by the FDA.
Did the physicians who were injecting the Botox know that they were using counterfeit Botox?
Absolutely. And in many cases, these were not even physicians. People can get a hold of this. You don't have to be a doctor. You don't have to even be a medical professional in order to get access. All you have to do is have cash and go online, or sometimes there are these representatives that will come around, or there are many faxes I used to get on a daily basis in my office trying to sell me cheap versions of Botox. They would even call it Botox, but you would know by the price tag that it was not.
I have actually heard that there are Botox parties going on around this country? Explain.
Well, it's really a shameful practice. Those of us who've been doing this a long time would never think of practicing medicine outside of our office, and certainly not without a license. Many times, again, these are non-medical professionals or non-professionals who are acquiring Botox, whether it's the real thing or counterfeit Botox, and over glasses of wine and other types of drink, they are having parties where you sit in a chair and inject this. And it's really amazing. I've actually seen quite a few cases come to my office after one of these Botox parties where, fortunately, there wasn't a lack of breathing, but there was a problem with one eyebrow going up, one down, you know, eyelids being saggy. Some people had problems swallowing if they had it in the neck area. So this is a real concern medically, if not from a terrorism point of view.
I have an interesting connection here looking at this, Diane. We primarily looked at biological weapons coming from nation states and then terrorist organizations more recently. Dr. Bob Cadillac and I did a study in 1995, though, talking about transnational criminal organizations being involved in this, and that's the link we'll talk about when we come back.
Indeed. We'll take just a short break and take your calls as well. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By Jeffrey Kenner, in appreciation of NPR's international coverage and its foreign correspondents. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
For this month's Reader's Review, a discussion of The Glass Room. The novel uses a masterpiece of modern architecture as a window into the hopes and fears of inhabitants. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And here's our first email from Ed, who says, I, too, have had Botox used on my larynx and vocal folds to freeze it preoperatively to learn diaphragmatic speech, then postoperatively to allow the pathology to rest and recover. Thank you for pointing out that Botox is used for more than cosmetic purposes. And we should point out, Dr. Alster, it's used for all kinds of dystonias.
Well, it's been used for decades to cure medical ailments ranging from migraine headaches and facial tics to other spasmodic conditions. We're talking about your own spasmodic dysphonia. It's really only been since 2002 that the FDA approved its use for cosmetic reasons. So it's been used very successfully for a number of medical conditions for decades.
On the other hand, we should point out that the FDA has not approved its use for conditions like my own, but There have been no situations where the FDA has come in and said, you cannot use it for spasmodic dysphonia.
Well, it's true that as a physician, I can use any FDA-approved product, even if it's for another condition.
An off-label.
An off-label condition. The main thing is to use an FDA-approved product and use your best medical judgment until the FDA is able to approve it for that condition. And that often takes many years. So in the case of such things as spasmodic dysphonia or even migraines for that matter, the FDA is a little bit behind in its approval process.
All right, Dr. Tina Alster, she's clinical professor of dermatology at Georgetown University. I know you must leave us. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much, Diane, for having me.
All right, and let's go now to Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning, Valerie. You're on the air.
Good morning to you all, and Diane, you are really sounding great, so yay for good Botox.
Thank you.
Yes. My question is, I guess it would be pointed directly at the colonel. Is he still there? Hello?
Yes. Go right ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, what it is, with what the would-be Christmas Day bomber did, getting on the plane with the explosives that he had, what would it take, or would there be like some type of chemist or scientist that would be posted at different stations in the United States at different airports to check and see? I mean, is there a capability where we would have someone that could come in, like when they're going through the machines, the X-ray machines or whatever?
Sure.
For somebody to spot this so-called, illegal Botox? Is there some way that they would know what it was?
Interesting question.
Well, just before we went on the air, I was talking to Diane about a little vial I carry around that has weaponized Bacillus globigii in it, which is nearly genetically identical to anthrax. And I carried it into the White House 9 days after 9/11. And you can imagine, I had no security clearance. I wasn't part of the government, worked in a small think tank at the time. Carried it into Vice President Cheney's office. And so you can imagine, security was pretty tight at the White House 9 days after 9/11. That's the problem.
Why did you do that?
Well, I always carried it around with me.
But
when people
why did you carry it into the White House?
Well, because I was going there to give a briefing on bioterrorism.
And you wanted to prove you could get through.
I didn't plan on using it, Diane. We were sitting there in a meeting, and the vice president said, what does a biological weapon look like? My friend looked at me and said, Randy, I pulled it out of my briefcase and says, sir, it looks like this. And by the way, I did carry it in your office. So to answer Valerie's question, no, we cannot have any sort of system. We can have a system to prevent someone from smuggling, highly enriched uranium through an airport or something with a radiological detector or whatever. We can find guns and things like that. It's very difficult to find liquid bombs. We know that. But try to find a dry powder like this is. I carry this through airports every time I fly, Diane.
Now,
I carried it into your studio today.
I carry dry face powder when I go through the airport. Is there no way to distinguish?
No. Not what they could have at an airport. The bomber on Christmas Day could just as easily have carried 3 to 4 pounds of dry powdered anthrax. And if you see, the White House released a report on November 23rd, 2009. It's on the White House website that says this could kill hundreds of thousands of Americans and cause more than $1 trillion of economic disruption for each event. That's why our commission is so concerned that America is not prepared.
Do we know how much of the counterfeit drug Mirena infiltrates the U.S. market?
Well, nobody can say exactly. Nobody can point the finger on the number. But we do know it exists, and we do know about all these parties and how people end up having paralyzed faces, basically, and having breathing problems. So that's the problem we're facing, and perhaps international community and U.S. government could lead this effort together with different stakeholders, could get together and develop some sort of common policy to tackle this problem, as well as study its implications to the international security and public health.
Ken Coleman, I gather that Botox is just one of the drugs in a booming trade of fake pharmaceuticals that range from cancer-treating medicines to knockoff Viagra. One U.S. investigator called the problem out of control. Now, how are U.S. consumers to know whether they've gotten the real stuff or a fake?
Well, the problem is much less prevalent in the U.S. than it is in other countries. So we should point that out right off the bat. We have wonderful controls in this country, although some, it is possible. For instance, there is a case of a woman in Marina Del Rey that did order growth hormone and Botox from the Internet and received it at her home. She was quickly arrested by the FBI, and it turned out that the Botox vial contained no Botox at all, and the growth hormone did indeed contain some growth hormone. So you don't know what you're going to get when you order some kind of counterfeit cheap drug over the Internet. So that should be pointed out right off the bat. Now, as far as interdiction or some kind of surveillance, what our report basically said is that this the larger issue of counterfeit drugs should be looked at, and in particular, the use of counterfeit or the production of counterfeit Botox needs a reassessment, and we probably need somewhat better surveillance to help this problem kind of move off our kind of red light list.
I want to ask about something that was in your report, Randy Larson, and that is in regard to Al-Qaeda talking about affecting or infecting the food supply in the United States. What do we know about that?
Well, when Tommy Thompson gave his last press conference to the Secretary of Health and Human Services a few years ago, he said, the one thing that worries me most is an attack on our food supply. And I think he had it exactly right. Mother Nature and sloppy technicians and workers do that every day. We saw spinach problems, tomato problems, and whatever. There's a great concern because there are certain choke points. We saw that recently with peanuts last year, where all these different producers all send it to one facility down there in North Carolina, and it goes through that choke point. So that is a concern. That's why it's very important. We can't – someone says we inspect only 2% of the food coming into the United States. That's probably a very optimistic high number. So it is a great concern. It is a vulnerability that we have to worry about. It is something that folks at the Department of Homeland Security and look at. You know, one of the crazy problems with food security is, Diane, if you get sick from a pepperoni pizza, that's the responsibility of the Secretary of Agriculture. If you get sick from a cheese pizza, that's the responsibility of the Secretary of Health and Human Services.
How ridiculous.
So until we fix the organization of food security in this country, it's not going to improve a lot.
All right, let's go to Eric, who's in Ionia, Michigan. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I work for the City of Detroit Fire Department EMS Division, and post 9/11, there was a big move to help train first responders, you know, for any terrorist, biological, or chemical attack. Now, we had some amount of training. They were supposed to be getting us gas masks and all this other stuff, and it's like the training ceased. Nobody has any protective equipment against any biological or chemical attack, and we're sitting on an international border, the city of Detroit. And, you know, the firefighters, they have the hazmat team, they have their level A and level B hazmat suits for mitigating any hazardous material response or even chemical or biological, but those of us that work on the ambulances have absolutely nothing, and it's appalling that we're the first line of defense for people that are ill or injured due to a terrorist attack or a chemical or biological attack, and we have absolutely nothing to protect ourselves. And, in fact, we would become victims immediately.
Randy Larson.
As would the technicians in the emergency rooms and the physicians. And, Diane, that's another reason why the grade yesterday was an F, a failing grade for what the commission says is the most likely WMD threat. And other study just came out yesterday by Rolf Moet-Larsen, who's the head of WMD for many years at CIA, WMD Terrorism, who's now at the Kennedy School. He said Al-Qaeda is very focused on WMD.
So with this, I gather, extremely lucrative trade, is it possible that terrorist groups might indeed use this as another source of revenue? Marina?
I would say definitely yes. Even if they cannot weaponize it somehow, they still can get profit from the selling of counterfeit voters. Just to give you an idea, for example, in Russia, the official vial, which would have 100 units of legal Botox, would cost about $500. The counterfeit Botox would cost $200. So right there on just one vial, which is would treat about 2-3 clients, you have $300 profit.
All right, let's go to Josh in Bethesda, Maryland. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you very much. This is a fabulous show.
Good.
I'm still a bit confused, and I don't think I ever heard an answer to Diane's very first question in the units that can help my confusion. So my precise question is, how many units are in that one nanogram that can kill you?
Can.
Let me point out that Botox vials in themselves are not security hazards, and this is a common point of confusion. There is.
I just want to know how many units per gram. I can't think about this quantitatively. If we're talking about units, then we're talking about nanograms. It costs almost nothing to make a nanogram.
Okay.
So let me see if I can help.
The point is, it's pure profit we're talking about.
All right, Josh. Josh, hold on. Hold on. Let Ken answer your question.
A bottle of Botox contains about enough to kill a mouse.
A bottle with 100 units of Botox?
Yes, it's a very, very small quantity. I think this is a really, really small amount. It is less than a grain of sand. It is a tiny, tiny amount in the nanogram amounts. And so these are not threats in any way, shape, or form to our national security.
In bioterrorism terms, Diane, we talk about LD50, which means 50% of those exposed would die. That's about one nanogram of botulinum toxin serotype A that's pure. So that's, you know.
But how would you deliver that?
Well, that's the difficulty that we're talking about. That probably makes us a little bit safer on this, because the Soviet Union, United States, never figured out how to spray it in the air. So you could contaminate food, but that's not really the weapon of mass destruction that we compare to spraying anthrax or smallpox or tularemia in the air. Could cause a lot of economic disruption, a lot of psychological and social disruption or whatever, but not on the same scale. It's very dangerous, but not on the same scale of the ones we are most concerned about, which is aerosolized anthrax.
All right. To Ralph in San Antonio, Texas, just to remind you, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Go ahead, Ralph.
Good to have you back, Diane.
Thank you.
First of all, I'm a medical service corps officer, and I've been trained in Suburnie, and been at this for like more than 14 years now. First of all, there are three problems to it. There's an academic problem. Everybody's concentrating on this as a microbiology issue, when in fact it's a geographic information science issue. That's one problem. Two, there are not enough PhDs within the United States right now to tackle the issue at a microbiology level or at another level. So three is educational funding problem that's going on within the university system right now. So my solution is very simple. Why not encourage more educational funding for civil military medicine? For example, veterans' preference for graduate school fellowships.
Randy Larson.
One of the three F's we gave in the report card was to the U.S. Congress for failing to properly support programs to bring more scientists, engineers, and language specialists into the U.S. government, particularly in our national laboratories and our intelligence community. I couldn't agree any more with the caller on that issue. In fact, Senator Graham, Senator Talent gave the U.S. Congress, their former organization, an F on that issue. One last point they wanted to know, just one of my really smart scientist friends told me that you could put 200,000 lethal doses on the head of a pin of botulinum toxin serotype A. That's how deadly it really is. But once again, the real problem is how you would dispense it. That's kind of the good news of the story. But that's how deadly it is, 200,000 lethal doses on the head of a pin.
Well, clearly, two issues here, lethality and the kind of Botox that truly is fake. So in both cases, it would seem to me the government has lots to be concerned about.
The U.S. government, the international community.
Indeed. Marina Voronova-Abrams, Dr. Tina Ulster was with us at Georgetown University, Colonel Randall Larson, and Kenneth Coleman. We'll expect to hear something tonight. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones.